nodded. "A daughter. She's on the school board here."
"Think she'd be worth talking to?"
"Hell, I don't know. I never met her."
"You're a liar. I heard you ask Phyllis about her. And what's the story on the room in the basement?"
He studied me. "Her name is Connie, but Gerald used to call her Izzy for Isadora Duncan. The one that got killed in that Bugatti when his scarf got caught in the spokes of the wheels back in 27. Actually, it was an ammo car, but her chauffeur's name was Falchetto, and she used to call him Bugatti." He shook his head at me.
"Anyway, Connie was one of those ballet dancers. They say a really good one, but she got caught up in drugs trying to keep her weight down, and anyway, Phyllis and Gerald kept her in that basement bedroom and got her clean. Model citizen these days."
I turned to watch my pet Kodiak snuffle the tires of a Jeep Cherokee.
"Dog!"
He sniffed a few more times, just to show his independence, and then joined the two of us at the door.
"Lucian, you take him and get settled in."
The old sheriff looked up at me.
"Where the hell are you going?"
I stuffed the folder Sandy had given me under an arm.
"Upstairs to 12. Plenty of time for that tomorrow. I still have the greatest of hope that I can salvage my trip to Philadelphia."
He stared at me for a moment, said nothing, and then slipped the key in the loose lock, followed by Dog, who never met an open door he didn't consider an invitation. Lucian flipped on the light and shut the door behind them. I stood there listening to the 18-wheelers jake-braking on the interstate. As I turned to go, I saw the curtain in the window of number 6 slowly pull closed. I thought about knocking on the door, but instead walked over and looked at the only other vehicle parked in the lot, the one that Dog had irrigated, with Idaho plates 6B22119. Boise County, City of Boise. There was also a Boise State snorting Bronx sticker in the rear window, along with the black and white sticker of the Lauburu, otherwise known as the Basque Cross. Even with the Basque population of my county, an odd vehicle to be parked in this lot.
"If you're here to run me off, it's not going to work."
I turned and looked at the tall young woman with a thick mane of dark hair pulled up in a ponytail, backlit by the light from room 6.
"Excuse me?"
She hugged herself, and I figured it was the cold, but maybe just a habit.
"I'm not intimidated by any of you."
I glanced around to indicate to her that I was alone.
"Okay."
"I saw you looking at my car."
"It's a nice car."
"Well, it's not going anywhere."
I repeated myself, "Okay." Feeling I should make some kind of effort in Western hospitality, I stepped forward and raised a hand to shake hers. "Walt Longmire, I'm the sheriff of Absaroka County." She stared at my hand, her arms still wrapped around her chest, one set of fingers clutching the doorknob in an attempt to not let too much of the cold enter the room.
"This is Campbell County."
I pushed my hat back on my head with my now free hand.
"Yes, it is. And you are?"
She sighed and said her name mechanically.
"Lorea Urecha."
"Basque?"
Her chin came out a little farther, and her head turned, the high brows and cheekbones highlighted in the small amount of illumination. Classically beautiful, but with character.
"Yes."
My attention was drawn to a Cadillac Escalade EXT that had entered the parking lot to travel down the rows of rooms, the vehicle slowing when it got in front of us. The windows were fogged, but from the dash lights I could see that it was a woman behind the wheel. She slowed almost to a stop, but then looked more closely at my truck, the stars and the bars, and quickly pulled away. I got a glance at the plates as she rounded the Aces and Eights Bar and Cafe at the corner of the motel at 17 Campbell County. Turning back to the young woman, I stuffed my hand in my pocket. "Been at the motel long?" She didn't say anything at first, but then spit the words,
"Is this an interview or an interrogation?"
"Actually, it was just a question."
She turned her head away from me, and I lost her profile. I glanced back at the closed office and the now lit no-vacancy neon light that Rankaj Patel must have turned on just before turning in.
I can always ask the hotel manager if you'd like.
I'd like. She stepped back, her lips compressed, and shut the door in my face.
I stood there looking at the closed door and then raised my fist. Go Bronx! You crafty devil, you certainly played her like a Stradivarius. I turned and started up the metal steps by the office, stopped at the landing and looked at the numbers on the rooms, until I got to the one with the yellow plastic tape that read, Police Line Do Not Cross. Thoughtfully, the Gillette PD and the Campbell County Sheriff's Office had simply put the barrier on the door so that you could open it without having to retape. Convenient. I slipped the key in and turned the knob, stepped inside, and closed the door behind me as I turned on the light. The heat in the room was turned off, and it was cold. Cold enough to still see my breath. Like a meat locker. With more than 30,000 suicides a year, the act is the 10th leading cause of death in the United States. The rates for those above 65 years of age are much higher than the average. And Holman was 67. 56% of male suicides are a result of firearms, whereas with females, the predominant choice of departure is an overdose. Most suicides occur as a result of depression, but there are some where the motives are never fully ascertained. This line of thought is of little comfort to the survivors, but sometimes helpful to the investigating officer, who can become so immersed in the case that he or she is tempted to slash his or her own wrists. I flipped on the light in the bathroom and took in the chipped, stained porcelain, the worn tile, and the mold on the shower curtain. The thin towels were still hanging folded on the rod, and the little cakes of soap were still wrapped in paper and sitting beside the unused sample bottle of shampoo conditioner. Even the toilet paper still had its folded and pointed edge. My compliments to housekeeping. I turned off that light and moved into the main room, past Gerald Holman's suit jacket and three-quarter-length parka, both carefully draped on hangers below the chrome shelf where his bone-colored cattleman's hat still sat, brim up. Nonetheless, his luck had run out. Or he had run it off. There were more tape lines set up that farmed off the area around the bed, where Gerald actually shot himself. Which was fine by me because I saw no reason to get any closer to the gore. The majority of the blood was centered not on the bed, but on the floor, where he slid after he had shot himself. Evidently his upper body had been thrown back by the impact, but then had bounced off the bed, which forced his lower body and legs forward, where he slipped onto the floor and bled out. Usually, when an individual shoots himself in the head, the weapon falls from his hand onto his lap, but from the photographs in this case, I knew that Officer Holman had been well trained because the Colt Python had still been clutched in his constricted hand, a product of cadaveric spasm. This is a sure sign that the victim died with the weapon in hand. No one could place the revolver there and recreate the same effect. In the movies, the individual usually slips the barrel of the gun in his mouth, pulls the trigger, and a brief spray of blood fans from the back of his head onto a wall, usually white for cinematic effect. Then the victim's eyes roll back in his head, and he falls sideways, leaving a relatively undamaged face with which the mortician can work. I've seen the aftermath of more than my share of suicides, and I've never seen one that ended like that. Instead, according to the armament, the effects are devastating. The photographs in the folder under my arm told the tale of the Remington 158-grain semi-wad cutter that had traveled through the roof of the investigator's mouth at over 1,200 feet per second, taking off the top of his head and the majority of his face from the bridge of his nose up. I didn't need to see the soot and powder trace results or the evidence of blowback material on the Colt to know who and what had done the deed. There was only one question that continued to puzzle me. Why twice? Because Gerald Holman was shot in the head two times. The only scenario is that 2 weeks ago today, he had raised the big revolver up in his left hand and shot himself in the left cheek. Then he had placed the barrel of the .357 in his mouth and finished the job. He had started his career in law enforcement
with the Wyoming Highway Patrol in the freewheeling 50s, then had accepted a job as a deputy in the Campbell County Sheriff's Office in the 60s, where he had been promoted to undersheriff in the 70s, ran for sheriff himself in the 80s, had lost, but then had accepted a position as an investigator. After retirement, he returned to duty in the cold case task force that Sandy Sandberg had created for him. A half century standing behind a badge. Gerald Holman knew where to point a weapon to kill a person. So, why would he shoot himself in the cheek? There seemed to be only one answer, and it wasn't contained in the report from DCI. And that was that Gerald Holman did something that, to my knowledge of him, gleaned from his wife Phyllis and both Sandy Sandberg and Lucian, he had never done to another human being. He had punished himself. Chapter 2 Aces and Eights is a poker hand generally referred to as the dead man's hand. This particular combination of cards arrived at such notoriety by being the one held by Wild Bill Hickok in Saloon 10 at the time of his demise in Deadwood, South Dakota, a little bit east of where we now sat. According to popular opinion, Hickok held only four cards, the Ace of Spades, the Ace of Clubs, and two Black Eights. The subsequent draw for the deprived fifth card having been interrupted by broken-nosed Jack McCall, who fired a bullet through Bill's head that exited his right cheek to rest in the wrist of a fellow card player, the fifth card being the least of Wild Bill's problems at that point. Getting breakfast at the rundown cafe of the same name as the dreaded dead man's hand was as elusive as Wild Bill's hole card. The short counter was where the waitress supposedly served meals, but she was a little slow in responding, and getting a second cup of coffee was proving difficult. We'd gotten the first cup all right, but refills appeared to be in high demand, which was strange since we were the only customers in the place. Every once in a while, the young Hispanic woman who had poured us our initial cup rushed through the restaurant, and we'd ceremoniously hold up our mugs, but she would continue on and out the door. Lucian watched as the girl breezed in again, once more ignoring our two-mug salute and disappearing through the swinging kitchen doors. "Damn! What do you got to do to get another cup of coffee out of that Mexican jumping bean?" "Lucian." He flipped the side of his old hunting coat back, the one that had the 1951 Wyoming Rifle Association patch on the shoulder, and rubbed at the small of his back where the rented bed had not agreed.
"What?"
A gaze into the kitchen, where I could vaguely see the smoky visage of the ghost of breakfast future. "I think she's cooking our Denver omelets.
Think they'll be done before the fire alarm goes off?"
The old sheriff studied the massive coffee urn at the bar back, and I could see him eyeing the prospect of climbing over the counter to get at it. The young woman passed us again, and we raised our mugs to no avail.
"So what did you see up there in room 12?
I sat my coffee down and looked at him. "Apparently, a man killed himself."
"I knew I trained you well."
He continued to stare at the brushed stainless steel surface of the coffee urn longingly.
"No question about it?"
I swirled the tiny bit of coffee at the bottom of my own cup in an attempt to make it last.
"You read the report, look at the pictures?"
"Nope.
I just called those assholes over here at the field office, and they made it clear that they were doing me some kind of big damn favor by talking to me. They said that as far as they were concerned, he'd killed himself, and that was that. Case closed."
I reached over and tapped the thick manila folder that sat between us. "That the investigator who did the scene?"
"Two of them."
"I'll talk to them, but if I have to, I can get in touch with T.J. Sherwin." I left my hand on the report. Instantaneous rigor in the strong side hand, trace elements. He nodded.
"I figured as much."
"There's one thing, though." He turned his head at the tone of my voice. "He shot himself twice." I watched the dark eyes sharpen.
"With that big .357?
"Yep," I sighed. "Wad cutters.
Seems like once would have been enough."
"If he had wanted it to be." He raised his mug to his lips, but then, remembering it was empty, set it back down.
What's that supposed to mean? Either somebody else shot him first, or your friend, Investigator Holman, raised that big revolver up and pointed it in his own face and pulled the trigger. Then he stuck it in his mouth and blew out the top of his head. Now, why does a man do that? Lucian scooted his cup toward me, and a sadness seemed to overtake him as he spoke quietly.
I don't know. I don't know what comes over a person to be driven to the point where they don't see any other way out than...
His words stuttered to a stop.
I just don't understand any of it. I guess I fought so hard to keep my life that I can't conceive of a situation where I'd voluntarily give it up.
The old sheriff sat there moving his jaw in anticipation of the words.
Why would he do that?
Possibly to punish himself?
For what?
I guess that's what I really have to find out. I glanced around. And why here?
Hell, he was probably waiting on a cup of coffee.
I repeated the question and then added, Did you see his house? Spotless. He wouldn't stay in a place like this unless there was a reason. He nudged the handle of his mug with a thick thumbnail.
Maybe he didn't want to make a mess for Phyllis to have to clean up.
I sat there quietly for a moment. Hey, Lucian.
What?
That story you told me in the Holman driveway about the woman you used to come over here and see on Sundays.
That was Phyllis, wasn't it? I warned her.
He turned and looked at me again.
I told her that you were a force to be reckoned with, and that if she didn't want the answers, she better not have you ask the questions.
You've got a lot of women in your past. Absent-mindedly, he lifted his mug and then slammed it down.
Yeah, and I'm pretty damn proud of it.
Were you driving when she was hurt? He pivoted on his stool to look at me, and his glare was like a blast furnace.
No, I wasn't. And this doesn't have a damn thing to do with the case.
I didn't look at him, but stared straight ahead and spoke in a low voice.
Maybe you better tell me the story, and I'll decide if it does or not. You go to hell!
It'll be a matter of public record, but I'll be wasting more time looking it up.
Wasting time is right.
I didn't move, and if I'd had more coffee, I wouldn't have drunk it. I did one of the things I do best. Ask a question and then wait for the answer. Something he'd taught me quite a few years ago. Our waitress passed through again, once more leaving our mugs like ships in the night. After a while he turned back and thumbed his coffee cup some more. He took a deep breath and I could feel the emotion leave him.
But I was in the car.
I continued to wait and then listened.
We was headed down Route 59 for the rodeo in Cheyenne. Hell, I don't know. She wanted to see men fall off horses or some damn thing. We'd been drinking. This is back before she was married to Gerald. Hell, they didn't even know one another. You remember how it was? They used to hand you mixed drinks out of the drive-thru in every bar in Wyoming, to-go cups.
I remember. He sighed.
She was in a hurry, like a damn fool. I bet her $100 bill that we wouldn't make it, and let me tell you, she put her foot into that El Dorado, and we damn well flew.
His jaw moved up and down, chewing on the words he said next.
Wasn't even another car involved. We came around one of those big, sweeping turns, and the thing just decided it wanted to go to Nebraska. She didn't have on her belt, and... flew out on the first roll.
He didn't say anything more, and just sat there. You're not doing this for him. You're doing it for her. He stared into the empty mug. I let the dust settle and patted the report.
No signs of drugs, alcohol. He didn't drink.
At all?
Nope.
I dwelled on Phyllis Holman.
What did she say about him?
I leaned in closer. Change in sleeping habits, lack of appetite, sex, disinterest in the job. He shrugged.
You'll have to ask her that.
No, you will. You know her, and she's more likely to open up to you.
The waitress passed us again, and both of our mugs levitated from the surface like some magic act and hovered there before slowly returning in tandem to the counter.
I don't think I want that.
I was getting a little annoyed.
Then what do you want?
He flipped his coat back again, and I thought he was going to rub his back some more, but instead, he quickly drew his Service 38 from its holster, extended his arm, took careful aim at the coffee urn, and fired. The sound in the enclosed space of the cafe bar was like a falling tree, and the thing bucked against the bar back like a wounded felon before spouting a single jet of coffee out onto the floor behind the counter. The old sheriff holstered the Smith & Wesson, hooked the handle of his mug with a forefinger like a talon, leaned forward, and held the cup under the stream to fill it. The young waitress appeared at the door with both hands at her mouth. Lucian turned his head, grinned, and threw her a quick wave before she backed through the door and ran away. After filling his mug, he took mine and held it just away from the gusher.
Cup of coffee?
The sheriff's office in Gillette was a big one by Wyoming standards, and to me it looked like a fort set down in hostile territory. I didn't know anybody in the outer sanctum. Sandy Sandberg must have been in his office, but they all knew Lucian.
There was this one time where we had this crazy guy from over our way that was after his wife and her boyfriend and drove over here, killed both of them, and was on his way out the door with a pump shotgun.
I watched as the old man's eyes glinted in the storytelling.
There was a whole mess of us, but you know how those things go when you're dealing with the deranged. Somebody's going to get shot.
He shook his head.
The crazy son of a bitch was on the porch waving around that 20-gauge and screaming and yelling about how he was going to kill everybody, and we're taking cover behind the vehicles when I reached in the trunk of my Nash Rambler for my own scatter gun and noticed the vacuum cleaner I had in there.
I studied the plaques on the entryway wall and noted that Sandy was a member of the Wyoming Stock Growers Association, the Masonic Lodge, the Powder River Shrine, Caliph Horse Patrol, Elks Lodge, and the Wyoming Sheriffs and the National Sheriffs Associations.
So I fetched the thing out and started walking toward this loony like I was there to sell the crazy bastard a vacuum cleaner.
He turned and swept his eyes over the half-dozen deputies who listened in nostalgic rapture.
I had the thing in there to drop it off to get worked on, but I just walked up to that man and started telling him all about the benefits of having this vacuum cleaner.
I wasn't sure if it was the retelling of Lucian's story or the thought of all those associational responsibilities that was wearing me out. But I wasn't aware that Sandy was standing beside my chair until I heard him laughing at the old sheriff's story.
Well, crazy as a waltzing pissant, this guy starts screaming that he's going to kill me. But I just kept telling him about the vacuum cleaner and how he was going to need it to clean up the mess in there. Well, sure enough, he starts listening, and after 40 minutes I traded the crazy son of a bitch the broken vacuum for the shotgun.
Sandberg tapped on my shoulder and nodded toward the sanctuary of the Campbell County Sheriff's Office. Unnoticed by the assembly, I stood and followed him down the short hallway. He partially closed the door behind us so that we could still hear Lucian's voice.
He'll be telling that story for the next hour, and I'm betting you've heard it before.
You'd be right. He crossed around his large wooden desk and sat in an oversized ox-blood leather chair.
So I hear you had a lively breakfast at the Aces and Eights this morning.
Lucian has a somewhat unique perspective on self-service. I was just along for the ride. He glanced at what I assumed was an incident report that had been taken by the nice young patrolman we'd met this morning and straightened the stack of papers on his leather-trimmed blotter.
Mr. Patel of the Wrangler Motel Corporation has agreed to not press charges if you replace the mortally wounded coffee urn today.
I glanced up at the mounted elk above his head.
Okay. They've got nice ones at the Kmart on South Douglas Highway. I had to buy a new one for the bullpen a month ago.
Somebody shoot it?
Nope, natural causes.
He leaned back in his chair and considered me.
It's where I get most of my supplies. Kind of puts a whole different meaning to Blue Light Special.
Yep. He said nothing for a while, but then spoke.
You seem kind of down, Walt.
I shrugged. Hey, I heard that little spitfire of an undersheriff of yours got sliced and diced in that cluster down near Powder Junction. I studied him back, but said nothing.
Vic all right?
Yep.
He continued to look at me.
You want to talk to Richard Harvey?
I suppose so.
Good.
Because he's standing behind you. I got up and turned to meet Gerald Holman's replacement. A tall man, built like a fence post, with a weathered complexion, wiry hair, an impressive handlebar mustache, and caramel-colored eyes. I extended a hand, and he took it. Walt Longmire. He nodded, sizing me up.
Inspector Harvey.
I surmised from that we were on a formal basis. Sandy spoke from where he sat.
You want to have a seat, Inspector?
He placed his big hands in his trouser pockets, the action revealing a badge on his belt, and, in a holster, a 5.86 Smith & Wesson 357, the same type of weapon that Gerald Holman had killed himself with. But this one had ivory handles with some kind of medallion inset.
I'll stand.
So it wasn't just for me.
Sandy squeaked in his leather chair. Sheriff Longmire is continuing the investigation into Holman's death, and we're going to help him in any way we can.
The inspector jiggled his car keys and some loose change in his pocket.
He's wanting to know about Holman's caseload.
It's all in the file I gave you. He sounded as if he was from the southwest somewhere. I'd like the individual files. Harvey glanced at Sandy.
Those are ongoing investigations.
Sandberg smiled.
In any way we can, Inspector. Now, why don't you take the sheriff here down to your office and get him those files?
Harvey tilted his head just a little, glanced at me, and then back to the Campbell County Sheriff. Without any further word, he turned on a cowboy heel and started toward the door as Sandy called out,
"You're excused, Inspector."
The fence pole paused at the door and looked back at me.
"You coming?"
I glanced at the sheriff, who was grinning, and followed the inspector down the hallway. Taking a hard right, we passed Lucian, who continued to inspire the troops with tales of yore, stood at the elevator and waited for the car to arrive.
Phoenix. He stared at me without a smile. Albuquerque.
Retired?
Once.
I nodded and watched the numbers rise.
How long have you been here?
10 with Arizona Corrections, 10 with the APD, 7 with Denver, and then transferred up here from the DCI field office about 6 months ago.
Decide you wanted to shovel snow?
Something like that.
Sandy trying to get rid of you?
He glanced at me and nodded. I don't think he likes me.
As charming as you are, how can that be?
The small car arrived, and he gestured for me to step in.
Probably thinks you're going to take his job.
Harvey joined me in the elevator, and